Crossroads is a housing program primarily for women who've been incarcerated, who are homeless, and who have addiction and mental health disorders. What we do is we start working with the women, most of them while they're still in jail, and assess with them if they think that they want to work on getting out of whatever cycle they've been in that has had them going back to jail often repeatedly and into cycles of homelessness.
And I remember from presentations you've made at the legislature that you've been successful, or not just you, but the program has been successful in terms of the women who graduate from it.
Mm-hmm. We have been successful. And, you know, success, how we measure success is always an interesting thing. And it's important to understand. We start working with women in jail. Many of the women we start working with there move from jail to eventually Maya's Place, which is a transitional housing program. Maya's Place sees varied levels of success because it is the point in time at which the women tend to be the most vulnerable. It's a point in time where exiting jail, there can be a lot of instability, trying to figure out what their mental health needs may be, their addiction needs, their medical needs. We oftentimes encounter women who've been victimized by domestic violence. They might have traumatic brain injury. There might be cognitive impairments. And by and large, those are things that have gone unassessed or unattended to, or unattended to effectively for years. Most of it precedes anything the women ever did to land themselves in jail or prison. And when they end up coming to us at Maya's Place, we start trying to help them sort that out. But it's a vulnerable time, and I think it's a scary time, and it's also a time when we see a little bit more attrition. But the Crossroads, which is the next kind of level of the housing program, which is scattered site supportive housing, which means that the women live in apartments throughout the city of Albuquerque, and we have at any given time 27 to 30 apartments. They're living in those apartments, but still, you know, participating with us in services that they feel that they need to continue to move towards self-sufficiency or independence. And in that housing program, we've seen a couple things happen that really are measures of success. One is women are staying in general much longer than they have. So our average length of stay is now between 2 and 3 years, which is really marked success in terms of stability and stability for the women with their children and moving their lives forward. We have more women entering higher education or getting their GEDs than ever before in the history of our program, with graduates now from local colleges and universities, which is really exciting, exciting for us, but even more exciting for the women who will tell you, you know, this is the biggest thing I've ever done on my own. And then the other marker that, of course, we look at and other folks are interested is, you know, recidivism rates and how many of those women actually go back to jail or prison. And, you know, we are way under, I think, 20% or 15% of the women who come through our program end up recidivating while they're in the program. And once they've graduated, that number is even smaller. Yeah. And a lot of times the recidivation or recidivism is related to a probation violation or something that, and it's not to diminish crime in any way, but for example, last year we had a woman get pulled over by law enforcement and her registration for her vehicle wasn't up to date. Wow. And that's a probation violation. So she was put back in jail. And she actually was doing very well in the program. And we've had more than one woman have that exact same experience. And that's hard for us because we see these women, you know, doing really, really well. And honestly, the fact that they have a vehicle is amazing. And things like getting registration, yeah, that's a life skill. You know, we take it for granted. It's not something everybody understands how to do or what to do. And so the fact that the women didn't have it and it got them in trouble, that's not good. But it's something for us to work on. But it, in the scheme of things, it seems like such a lesser issue. And the unfortunate thing is it's a probation violation and oftentimes we'll send somebody back to jail.
Boy, that's amazing. Since you came to New Mexico, you've been involved in a lot of service delivery to women in various agencies. And you seem to be kind of committed to working here in New Mexico.
Right. I love New Mexico and I'm here I came to New Mexico almost by accident, although I'd been here, as many of us have, as a tourist. And I'm one of the ones from the Midwest who fell in love with the landscape in New Mexico. And my educational background is social work, and for almost 30 years now, I've worked in a number of arenas with folks who tend to be the folks that are, to use buzzwords, more disenfranchised, more marginalized, with less access and less equity of care in the human services realm. And so, you know, my career has involved working in HIV and AIDS and working with women involved in prostitution in the city of Detroit, working with homeless and runaway youth. And then, you know, coming to New Mexico, I was working in domestic violence in Santa Fe and then the Rape Crisis Center here in Albuquerque, and now here at Crossroads. And really, Crossroads feels like a culmination of everything I've done in my career and bringing it all together here. And the women that we work with have survived and prevailed over some of the most challenging life circumstances that anyone can imagine. And what's interesting is that as a society, we tend to make those women invisible. You know, oh, you've been incarcerated or you're struggling with addiction or whatever. But when you really hear what the women have surmounted, you realize that these are some of the most amazing people you will ever meet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so I was just talking to you at a conference lately because I noticed that you were selling your motorcycle, and I wanted to see how, if you'd been successful. And then I found out that it was in order to pay for a wedding.
Well, selling the motorcycle is actually something I've been trying to do for a little while now. It's a really nice bike, Harley Davidson. But yes, I did say to you, and it may be a little more in jest than not, but if I could sell the motorcycle, it certainly would help with paying for this upcoming wedding that I'm having with my partner, which then led to our conversation about, you know, this flurry of activity that's happening in New Mexico around the kind of repealing back of the ability for same-sex couples to file for licenses and then get married in, you know, I think we're up to 7 counties now in the state. My partner and I hopped on that bandwagon and got ourselves a marriage license and are now planning a November wedding. And there's a lot of things that go along with that, Susan, that I had no idea I'd be up for.
Well, you said that you didn't ever pay attention to the details of a wedding. And I guess you didn't grow up sort of imagining yourself involved in that kind of ceremony.
Well, right. And, I can't say that every gay man, lesbian, anybody in this situation would say that the same thing, because I think a lot of people do have dreams of marrying the person that they love. It just, for me, was never really part of my psychological, you know, sphere. And it's never been an option. And so I, you know, maybe subconsciously even just kind of blocked it out and, didn't really pay attention to, certainly not all the details of what goes into a wedding. But as you and I were talking, you know, I have realized in all of this process that, you know, quite probably I might not have, if this issue weren't so plagued with, you know, the homophobia and kind of the bigotry and, you know, this defiance of, you know, somehow there's aspects of our society that still think that, you know, anybody is a lesser person or doesn't deserve access. If those things weren't quite as hot as they are in terms of topics, and if I didn't feel kind of the pain of that or the implications of that on a more personal level, you know, marriage might have felt differently to me, but I do feel compelled. I mean, my partner and I talked about it, and she actually asked me to marry her a long time ago. And I said, sure, baby, when it's legal, right? In our state. So also, you know, the idea that for so many same-sex couples, they've had to travel. They traveled out of state. Some of them traveled out of the country. And, you know, like I was saying to you the other day, it makes me at one time both sad and then on the other hand, you know, kind of angry that, you know, we put people in a position of, you know, because it's there's so much disparity in this that, you know, okay, well, you can get married, but only in Vermont, or you can get married, but only in Canada, or, you know, you have to go to the UK to get married, whatever it is. And, you know, I was one that was refusing to do that. And yeah, I guess I did travel a little bit. I went from Bernalillo County to Santa Fe County. Even though the next day Bernalillo County turned over and our county clerk started issuing the licenses. But it's, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, and I was mentioning to you too that there's also a certain sadness, I guess. And I don't know if everyone feels this way, but I know, you know, we were in Santa Fe at the county clerk's office with people who had been together for 33 years. And, you know, the tears were streaming down their faces. And, you know, I think it was this joy, this relief, and also somehow this sadness or this grief. And, you know, waiting that long to, you know, get some recognition. And then for so many people, you know, getting married immediately, which is not kind of the social norm for heterosexual folks who, you know, have the luxury of planning and thinking about it and, you know, preparing and, you know, need more time than what I have until November to do it. but it's interesting. I just think that, you know, people feel like, I got to do this now and I got to do it all the way. Otherwise, it's going to be taken away from me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I find that really sad and painful. And
how does your family feel? What are they going to be coming here? And how does her family feel?
She has kids, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the family's. So on my side of the family, it's primarily my stepmom, and she's great. I mean, we called her right away, and she joked with us because we had just gotten back from a big trip, not a long trip, but an exciting trip to California. And she said, "You're doing it all backwards. You just took your honeymoon, and now, you know." So she's been great, and she actually called. She doesn't like to fly, so she called a week ago and said, "I got my train ticket. I'm coming." And really, that was some of the most meaningful news for me. My partner's family, they're mostly in New Mexico. And the fun thing about her family's involvement, really, for me, has been listening to her talk to her two brothers about her wedding outfit. So her two brothers have been so supportive of her and patiently, you know, one lives in northern New Mexico and the other one actually is overseas right now. He's retired military, but he's overseas with his wife. And he has been painstakingly going through websites with her. And so they're on the phone together looking at, you know, bridal things, and he's giving her ideas. And there's just something so endearing for me about these, you know, it breaks some of the gender rules, and I love that. And they've just been so supportive. So that's, you know, that's been good and exciting. I mean, honestly, the biggest issue for us has been getting addresses for people to invite to the wedding. So that's where we're kind of stuck now. The kids, we have there's a 19-year-old boy, and he is going to be the best man in the wedding. And he's actually, you got to switch it up a little. He's actually he's going to be my partner's best, I don't know, bride's, the groom's maid, I guess. and then her youngest son, you know, when she saw him for the first time after she told him, he said right away, "Congratulations, Mom." So, I mean, the boys have been great and supportive, and, you know, it, I think like many families, you know, there's been challenges. Now, my family, unlike her family, is more used to me because I have been living as an out lesbian for, you know, 40 years of my 50-year life. And they, you know, at first it was, I think, you know, the same thing that goes on. You know, don't you think you just want to wait a while before you proclaim anything? And, you know, it, but later in life, it has really been no big deal and very supportive. And they would, you know, wave me off to the Michigan Women's Music Festival for 18 years of my life. You know, have fun, they'd say, and there I'd go. And really, you know, really supportive, really loving. I mean, the hard part is my dad passed away a year and a half ago, and he and my partner were particularly close. And I know that she really wishes he could be here. I really wish he could be here. And I think he would have cried like a baby, and I think he would have been really excited for us. So, you know, that piece has been good. I mean, we'll see what happens, you know, from a social perspective. Like, what does it mean? I just, actually, right before you came here, I was on the phone with my tax guy who's preparing my taxes. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, this whole marriage thing's going to change things, and you might want to change your exemptions at your office. And I was like, oh, no, here we go. You know, and again, these are things that... I don't know. Straight folks seem to have, you know, innately bred into them that they understand these things, and I've kind of pushed it away. And maybe I'm being ignorant like that, but there is a, you know, there is a learning curve for sure.
So do you feel different about do you think you feel different in your relationship now that you made this decision?
We have actually, you know, we've gone through some big stuff together. You know, the passing of my dad was big, and we've gone through some other trials and tribulations like that. But we've also gone through, like, building a house addition and kitchen remodel. And so now we're planning this wedding. And one of the things that I'm noticing for us is that there is, like, it's us. And I feel, and I could be making this up, but I do feel this acknowledgement of this space that is ours and it's us. And, you know, we refer to it, and things will come up on the television or the radio, and we'll say, oh, no, that's, you know, that's not, that'll never happen. And I don't know, there was something about a celebrity today, you know, going back to an old flame, and my partner, you know, said, that'll never happen. And so, you know, there's just this acknowledgement that, you know, this is, you know, this formal and soon to be very public kind of acknowledgement of this relationship. And that, you know, it's affirming. And so there's, you know, I think there's a graduated level of tenderness and compassion in our space, and also just some real frenzied activity up till midnight and up at 5 a.m. today to try to get address lists together and things like that.
Well, I hope it'll be a wonderful occasion. I hope the weather works out.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Yeah, we're actually having our ceremony out in Harris at this beautiful location, and I looked up the weather charts for November, and, you know, it could be as low as 35 degrees or as high as 75 degrees. And I'm like, okay, well, we'll take somewhere in between. But either way, I, you know, it'll be fun. And there's, you know, a lot of family, all family are being invited who are out in Michigan and other places around the country. So I'm hoping that we'll see a lot of folks coming to, you know, celebrate with us.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. Oh, God.